Welcome back to another edition of Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm entertainer writer Jim Hill, and Mr. Taylor, who has a lovely new haircut, by the way, and whose writings on the industry you can read over on The Wrap, and whose musings on the Mission Impossible movies you can listen to on Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. He and I are recording this week's show on Sunday, April 7th, 2024, and just before we get started here, Drew lobbed a goodie at me. Do you want to explain about this YouTube video?
Yeah, so I'm sure a lot of our listeners also watch the Corridor Crew YouTube channel, which is a really fascinating channel that's dedicated to animation and visual effects and all sorts of wonderful things. And I was telling Jim about this. They tried to recreate the process that Mary Poppins' visual effects were handled in a new way, the sodium vapor process. Which, Jim, do you want to describe what that was?
Oh, boy, that's kind of hard to... I mean, this is, you know, we'd have to dive into the Ub Iwerks story. I mean, you know, that. I mean, this is... I mean, it was so technically complicated. In fact, I was just reading the second volume of Julie Andrews' memoirs, and she was talking about... These scenes from Mary Poppins were such a moonshot for Disney. They were the very first things they shot. I mean, you know, that this is literally...
Oh, really? How,
you know, this is the first thing that she and Dick Van Dyke did in front of the cameras, which was the start of the Jolly Holiday number. But, God, it's like crazy.
It involved a magic crystal,
yeah.
Is the only thing that I can describe.
Yeah, yeah.
And They was not blue screen. It was not green screen. It was kind of a yellow screen.
Yeah.
And it allowed for all this transparency and motion blur. It was very ahead of its time. But from what I understand, those crystals have been lost to the hands of time. And on this video, they say it's the first time in over 30 years that even someone has attempted to do this for real. So it's pretty fascinating. I didn't get to watch the end of it, but we wanted to point everybody in that direction because it's really fun and a really cool piece of
Disney and
animation and visual effects history.
No, absolutely. You know, it's great fun. Only 12 minutes. Check it out, folks. You know, it was a fascinating moment in history for the company. And on the other hand, today, what? Looking at the weekend box office, second weekend in a row, Godzilla Kong, the new Empire is number one in North America, took in $31.7 million. On the other hand, if we check in on the animation side of the street, Kung Fu Panda 4, now in its fifth week in theaters, only took in $8 million. The domestic box office currently sits at $166 million. Overseas, $210 million. Worldwide box office, $376 million. And just so we're clear here, Kung Fu Panda needs to sell an additional $150 million worth of tickets overseas to equal what Kung Fu Panda 3 pulled in when it was in theaters back in January of 2016. That was just over $500 million, $521 million to be exact. But what's interesting to me, Drew, is that the digital HD version of Kung Fu Panda becomes available this week on platforms like Amazon Video and iTunes on Tuesday, April 9th, to be exact. Blu-ray, they're still being a little vague about. You know, they will say it's going to hit store shelves sometime next month in May. And then Forbes did an article back in March where they said that Kung Fu Panda 4 won't show up on Peacock till July 6th of this year, right? 120 days after this DreamWorks animation film was first released to theaters. So this is now the new revenue stream post-pandemic, right? So theatrical, digital distribution platforms, traditional retail channels, and then streaming, right? Followed by cable and network or vice versa.
Yeah, and it'll probably be on Netflix at some point as well.
Very true.
What they call the second or third corridors for digital distribution. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, it surprised me that it was going to be on digital so soon because it seems to be doing pretty well. But Yeah, I was at the theater at the AMC City Walk yesterday morning, and it was packed, and there were a ton of kids. So I assumed that that was Kung Fu Panda, Ghostbusters, Godzilla, Kong. Yeah.
There you go.
So I don't know.
Okay. Okay. So interesting time to be talking about animation and effects, again, effects-driven films. And by the way, more news to come, but I wanted to remind you that the news portion of today's show is brought to you by TouringPlans.com. And if you're headed down to Orlando anytime soon to visit some of the theme parks you'll find there, Touring Plans can help save you time. More importantly, it can help you save money. So before you book that flight down to Central Florida, please check them out at TouringPlans.com, and you can thank Drew and I later. All right, so big news this week. We now finally have a release date for Toy Story 5. This info came out of the shareholders meeting, which, by the way, Drew and I will discuss later on in the news segment. But Disney revealed post-shareholders meeting, I think this came out on Friday of last week, that this Pixar sequel will be arriving in theaters on June 19th, 2026. So, thoughts, Drew?
You know, when I was at Pixar, Jim, I saw people sweating profusely as they walked down the halls, and then I realized why that Toy Story 4, 5 was going to come out in 2026. No, I know that it's looking very good. The script is supposedly very funny and very touching, and
Okay.
I just got to get there. I mean, it seems far away to us, Jim, but it's going to be here before you know it, I'm sure.
Okay, and forgive me for climbing on a soapbox here, but look, I wasn't entirely a fan of Toy Story 4 back in June of 2019. I mean, I thought the original Toy Story, November 95, was a mind blower. I thought Toy Story 2 in November of 99 was the best sequel since Godfather 2. And then Toy Story 3 in June of 2010 did the impossible. It somehow topped Toy Story 2. But Toy Story 4 was okay. That said, I'm willing to give it a pass because it had a truly great ending. I mean, I love that she'll be fine. Bonnie will be fine. You know, I love that it let, you know, it left Bo Peep and Woody together, that those two earned a happy ending from everything that went on in the previous three Toy Story films. And I just don't want Toy Story 5 to undo that. And do we have any inkling at all about where 5 goes? Have you heard anything at all?
I have heard some things that I cannot reveal on air, but okay. Both will be back. Both Woody and Buzz will be back. Mm. How? I do not know.
Okay.
But yeah.
All right. So, there's a part of me that almost wishes that Pixar would do a midquel. I think that's what they called it back in the day, something that would either fall between the original Toy Story and Toy Story 2 or Toy Story 2 and Toy Story 3. And, you know, there is that direct-to-video sequel that Disney was readying for production at Circle 7 back in 2004. And I think we discussed previously on the show that that was about Buzz suddenly becoming defective, getting a glitch and having to be sent back to the factory in Taiwan. And only then, after they put him in the box and said a heartfelt goodbye, did the Woody's Room gang discover that, you know, they weren't going to send back Buzz, that the factory was actually going to destroy him along with all the other Buzzes. And so they all climbed into another delivery box, I guess. You know, they got in FedEx while Buzz was sent U.S. Postal and, you know, raced him, you know, to the factory with the idea that they were going to rescue him. And now, Drew, do you know that the script is actually now online for the Circle 7 version?
No. How did you not send this to me, Jim?
I just found it today. All right. You know, it was one of these.
Oh, my God. Please send it my way. We got to have Bob's back on the show to talk. Didn't Bob's come on and talk about
The interesting thing is that evidently there were a couple of different drafts. And I want to stress here that couple of different ideas that got floated, and you know, the Disney explored a bunch of different ideas before settling, you know, really leaning into the Taiwan thing. But one of them involved Andy's mom getting remarried and, you know, the whole blended family going to Mexico and, you know, and meeting El Buzzo and Mr. Papaya Head. And I'm blanking what the other one was, but evidently that this Taiwan idea was the one that got out there. And what's interesting is if you read the script, there are things in this that seem to walk out into Pixar projects. For example, there's a moment in the movie where Woody and the Andy's Room gang wind up in a daycare center in Taiwan where the kids who are toddlers, just like in Toy Story 3, are just brutal. You know, just going to just beat up the toys. And then when Buzz gets back to the factory, he finds out that the company that makes Buzz is about to launch a brand new character that's going to be sort of Buzz's co-worker in Star Command. He's called Dax Blastar. And what's especially interesting about Dax is he has a cat companion, just like Sox in Lightyear from 2022. I mean, look, it's entirely possible. Great minds think alike. You know, that Pixar had no knowledge of the script that was written for the Circle 7 version of Toy Story 3. But on the other hand, Drew, you and I know, especially now in the, you know, staff up and then let everybody go world of animation, that, you know, there are people who once worked for Disney who are now up at, you know, Emeryville at Pixar, or for that matter, folks who once upon a time worked at DreamWorks who wound up at Disney. And it's a very incestuous world where, you know, people share a lot of info. So, there's a part of me that thinks that the folks up in Emeryville must have been aware of what Circle 7 was up to. And I think we've talked previously about the other idea that was kind of intriguing about Circle 7's version of Toy Story 3, and that was Mr. Kayagi, the owner of the factory, the guy in charge of the toy company, who evidently knows that toys are alive. In fact, the whole notion of, you know, that he was going to be the only person on the planet who can actually, an adult who can talk to toys. And what was especially interesting about him is that evidently they patterned his look after Hayao Miyazaki. And I guess there was some talk about, wouldn't this give this film a certain amount of legitimacy if we could persuade him to voice the character? And it's like, you know, I believe the phrase is when hell froze over, you know, that, you know.
He's too busy chain smoking cigarettes and berating minions, to do it. Yeah.
That's probably entirely true. By the way, there's one mean joke in the script. And yes, sir, I'll send you a link so you can read it. But again, it turns out the Dax Blastar character is threatened by Buzz Lightyear and, you know, tries to do him in at the factory. And so in the end, the Woody gang bands together and pushes Dax into a shipping box. To kind of a mean bend on the story, they seal him up and then write the address of Sid Phillips, the kid next door who tortures toys. And, you know,
that's kind of a fun callback, though.
Yeah. But they're sending Dax to Sid's house. So anyway, long story short, Disney acquires Pixar in January of 2006. Circle 7 Studios closed. John Lasseter, the then head of Pixar and Walt Disney Animation Studios, says that from here on in, only Pixar will develop sequels to its films. But again, you know, sometime over the past 20 years, this script for Circle 7's Toy Story 3, and that idea, the notion of Buzz gets recalled, and the Andy's Room gang goes to rescue him. I feel like there's a movie there. There really is a movie there. Now, I'm going to tell you right up front, Drew, that when you read this, not every idea in this thing is a gem. Like, for example, that robotic cat that accompanies Dax Blaster, whose name is Comet, by the way, is written to be very early 2000s urban. So he's saying things like Foshizzle, the big man's in the house, and you are money, baby, and mad props dog, which I'm thinking really wouldn't have aged all that well, you know. So just saying, but anyway, long story short, I'm okay with the idea of, you know, that there's a Toy Story 5 headed our way. I just don't want them to screw up Woody and Buzz's happy ending, you know. So, you know, just okay. Anyway, we mentioned at the top of the new segment here, we're going to talk a little bit about the shareholders meeting. And Drew, you know, first of all, very short meeting. What, 56 minutes long? What was your take?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I did not expect to have a little sizzle reel. Pre-recorded sizzle reel from Bob Iger in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that had, that, you know, he played an extended clip from Inside Out 2. There was footage from Mufasa the Lion King. Mm-hmm. We saw that, you know, Moana concept art with some kind of creature behind her. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was pretty dull, and I thought it was fascinating how defensive he was about Epic Universe, which is a subject you and I talk about frequently.
In fact, well, our buddy BioReconstruct, you know, sort of called Iger out, I guess, because he said that what they had known for more than a decade that Universal was prepping a third, well, Universal would like us to say fourth theme park, because they you know, what is it? Volcano Bay is supposed to be the third theme park, and Epic Universe is supposed to be the fourth. But BioReconstruct pointed out that, I guess, Universal had only bought the land in 2008. And to be fair, once upon a time, Universal already owned that land. It was several management groups earlier. In fact, Drew and I were talking about this before we started recording here today, and that would have been Vivendi, right? That sold it off.
Yeah.
The notion was that Vivendi was trying to make the company that much more streamlined, and they Universal owned all of this land that previously been Lockheed's by the convention center. And the problem was that it had all of these Superfund related, you know, issues. There were toxic waste that had to be cleaned up. And the feeling was that, you know, we're trying to sell ourselves to GE at that point, right?
Right. Oh, my God, Jim. This is like taking me back. Back to the corporate owners.
Again, this is why you do a show with a 65-year-old man. I remember that.
Listen, I was living in Fairfield where GE was headquartered.
Oh, well, there we go.
Recall, yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
So,
well, the other Universal news that I just wanted to briefly bring up, nothing to do with animation, but how great is this tram tour, the 60th tram tour?
I will tell you my favorite part of what they're bringing back for this 60th anniversary summer. The Runaway Train. Have you ever seen any of the footage from the Runaway Train?
Never. I saw the collapsing, whatever, the landslide and a couple of the other things. Where you would get out and see the A-team van and stuff like that, but I've never seen the Runaway Train, so I'm so excited.
It was literally the tram tour equivalent of a jump scare. Okay, I mean, the notion is you are on the tram, you are driving through, you know, the area around Six Corners where they've been shooting westerns since like what 1910, and you know, you just come around a corner and here is this steam train whistle blowing and driving straight at the tram, and at the literally a foot away from the tram, it stops and then it backs up. And it just, I mean, it is so ridiculously low tech, but it was so beloved back in the day. And the fact that they're bringing it back for the 60th anniversary, that, you and I have
to. You got to come out, Jim. You got to come out
this summer. I'm definitely coming out. We're definitely doing that tram tour.
Okay, we're going to do it. Yeah. And I've never seen the earthquake scene either. So,
well, no. Now, remember, this is a brand new iteration on the earthquake scene. You know, they've had it shut down for the better part of a year, retooling the effects and that sort of thing, which had gotten, you know, a little slow in their old age. You know. And,
oh, this was when, like, the ceiling came down and the
oil truck slowly slides toward you. And then, and mind you, you know, I'm talking like the earthquake expert right now. Because, again, we had our 4.8
yes,
out here.
Yes, you did.
You know, which, by the way, I was talking with my daughter about this. And she's like, 4.8. We don't even get out of bed for a 4.8.
Yeah,
like,
we sleep through 4.8s. Yeah, for sure.
So
yeah,
it's like, oh, okay, my mistake. You know, shook our part of the continent. You know, sorry for waking you. So, all right, and finally, by the way, because I've repeatedly said this on the show, and everybody poo-pooed me, but it's just like the fact that the live-action Moana is in fact now going to open in the summer of 2026 rather than 2025. You know, I think it's Mr. Testa who says every show should feature a certain moment of self-congratulation. So I'm taking that one.
You did it, Jim.
I did. I got one thing right. One thing right. Okay. Anyway. Okay. We're going to jump to a commercial break here, folks, but when we get back, more Pixar-related stories as we look ahead to Elio, and we take a look back at The Good Dinosaur. But first, this. And we're back. Folks, what's nice about doing this podcast is Mr. Chael and I will regularly get mail from folks all over the place, so the people who enjoy fine-tuning. And one of those is Jose Mercader, a writer and journalist in Mexico City who reached out in mid-March to say, just wanted to let you guys know that McDonald's has released Pixar Elio Happy Meals here in Mexico, more than a year away from that film's release date. So far, they have released two characters, Glordon and Ambassador Ayla, and he mentions, and I'm obviously going to be hunting these things down. And by the way, Jose is not wrong. Once upon a time, Pixar's Elio was supposed to be released on March 1st, 2024. And this is why all of those McDonald's down in Mexico began offering Happy Meals with the Elio toys inside on March 27th of this year. 8 toys in total. We have Elio himself, Ambassador Grigon, which I believe Brad Garrett is doing the voice for, and then previously mentioned Glogorn, then Ambassador Cuesta, Ambassador Mira, Ambassador Helix, Ambassador Acquier, and then again an Aaliyah. And Drew, you remember this project? In fact, I think I was sitting next to you when this was revealed. This was in the works at the D23 Expo back in September of 2022, and the premise is classic Pixar. I mean, a teaser poster shows an 11-year-old boy being raised up into the sky by some sort of alien tractor beam. And catchphrase for the movie is, the universe called and got the wrong number. Have you previously seen this what is it, the bullet point, the pitch for the film? You know, do you want to read, you know, share with the class what it's supposed to be about?
It follows an 11-year-old boy named Elio who accidentally becomes the intergalactic ambassador of planet Earth after being beamed up to the Communiverse by aliens for making contact. Mm-hmm. Elio must form new bonds with eccentric alien life forms and survive a series of formidable trials. And I believe, as part of the D23 presentation, we saw that the mother, who is played by America Ferrera, is working for a kind of clandestine organization to, you know, initiate first contact, and instead they get Elio, which I think is very cute.
No. Well, you've nailed it in one. I think what we were shown, or what was suggested, that America Ferrera's character, she took her work home with her, and she was there at the family, PC, and evidently that's when the call came in from deep space, and You know, we don't know the particular story mechanic as to why, you know, Elio is at the computer at that time, but he's the one who gets sucked up into deep space. And for me, this sounds like a solid idea for a great Pixar film. And I did hear from a certain Disney insider, somebody who's right in the front lines when it comes to animated projects at the Mouse House. And he was telling me that, you know, this is a return to form for Pixar, that a Pixar film that would give you all the feels like Up or the original Inside Out or the first Monsters, Inc., you know, all, by the way, all Pete Docter films. But then something happens, all right? And this project, we got a teaser trailer and our poster in June of last year. It goes out into theaters along with Elemental. And then in late October of last year, 2023, we hear that Elio's release date has been pushed back by more than a full year. You know, going from March of 2024 all the way to June of 2025. And what's interesting is at that time, what we were hearing for the reason that this happened was what, the SAG-AFTRA strike, right? That, you know, started in mid-July of last year, wouldn't get resolved till 2009, and that was somehow tripping up the project. And forgive me here, folks, but what with Elio's release date getting pushed back that far, this brings to mind, to me at least, The Good Dinosaur. Kind of the same thing. Project first gets announced at the D23 Expo. In this case, it's back in August of 2011. And were you working for the company at that point, Drew? Or you know?
No, but I was in that. I was in the room. Okay. I mean, this was when it was in the old auditorium at the Anaheim Convention Center, that kind of space age looking one.
There we go.
This was a really memorable D23 too, because this was I think the same one where they did the weird Tomorrowland box unboxing thing.
And remember when they announced this project, they literally threw up a slide that said the untitled Pixar film about dinosaurs. And though that said, wasn't it we got wind that this was coming a couple of months or a couple of weeks early in June of that same year that Bob Peterson, the co-director and co-writer of Pixar's Up, had come up with a fun idea for a film, which was basically, what if the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs 66 million years ago missed Earth? And by the way, the Chicxulub crater, which is where the 6 mile in diameter asteroid hit eons ago, is largely located off the Yucatan Peninsula, which is Mexico. It's again, thanks to Jose, we got a theme going with this week's show. It's Mexico. All right. Anyway, also worth noting, when the asteroid struck, it wiped out 75% of the plant life and animals that were living on Earth at that time, and the only dinosaurs that survived were the ones who could fly, became the birds we know today. All right. Anyway, back to Pixar's untitled movie about dinosaurs. So, Drew, they announced what? At that point, it was going to arrive in theaters in November of 2013. Then April of the following year, again, D23 is held in 2011. April of 2012, we learned that this movie release date has been pushed back 6 months to now May of 2014, and it also has a title now. It's called The Good Dinosaur, and certainly Disney Consumer Products was hoping that it would be A Good Dinosaur, because, you know, especially for the company, because little kids just love dinosaurs. And case in point, The Land Before Time. Original Don Bluth movie comes out in November of 1988. By the way, Drew, beat the Disney's animated feature for that year, Oliver and Company, at the box office, but only by like $300,000. But Universal's Land Before Time then goes on to spawn 13 direct-to-video sequels, a TV series, as well as tons and tons of merch. And so, So this is why Disney was, you know, particularly consumer products, was just, you know, thrilled with that Good Dinosaur was coming over the hill, because they just wanted to merchandise the hell out of this movie. But then in 2013, we start to hear that things aren't going well behind the scenes up in Emeryville. I mean, at first it seems innocuous. We hear that Peter Song has been assigned to be the co-director. And hadn't he done which of the shorts? The one with the clouds?
Yeah, Partly Cloudy.
Partly Cloudy. And, you know, and again, it was one thing he said, ooh, Peter's getting on board. You know, the guy who made that movie, this will be great. But then we...
Well, actually, before that, Jim, not to correct your history here, but for a little while, they said that there was going to be a collection of filmmakers at Pixar that were going to oversee the production of Good Dinosaur. Ooh. Pete didn't get assigned until a little bit later. Wow. So at first, it was sort of like, all hands on deck, let's figure out how this movie is going to work. Mm-hmm. Pete ended up coming out of that sort of being the one assigned the project. So
yeah,
kind of an interesting process there.
Yeah, and what's kind of interesting is that Pete's take on this project, not to get ahead of ourselves here, but he went with a far simpler story, and it was... Wasn't it the whole notion that I think the catchphrase that nature is so strong it can even take down a sizable dinosaur or something to that effect? Mm-hmm. You know, so I mean,
yeah.
But anyway, now jump ahead to August of 2013, back at a D23 Expo, where we get the voice cast of Good Dinosaur introduced on stage. John Lithgow, Neil Patrick Harris, Bill Hader, who, by the way, none of these people are in the finished film. And wasn't it, you know, that's in August, and then in September, we learn that the Good Dinosaur is pushed back yet again, and we now have an Elio-sized push. We go from May of 2014 all the way to November of 2015, a full 15 months. But here's the thing. Because The Good Dinosaur was supposed to be released to theaters in May of 2014, Disney Consumer Products, because they wanted to have Good Dinosaur toys on store shelves a full 3 months ahead of the release of this film, which would have been February 2014, had already put in orders with factories overseas. And to make matters worse, Disney Consumer Products, after the fact, learns that many of the dinosaur good dinosaur characters that they had ordered from these factories to make toys of, have now been cut from this Pixar film. Because again, Peter's going with a smaller cast and a simpler story. And Drew, as someone who has written his own Chronicle Art of Book, the wonderful The Art of Onward, which if you don't have, folks, you should buy right now.
Pick it up.
But I if you want to have a sense of how big the cast of The Good Dinosaur once was, you need to chase down a copy of The Art of the Good Dinosaur, which Chronicle Books published back in November 2015. The inside cover of the front of the book of this 168 hardcover features... got to be 100 dinosaurs. I mean, you got Triceratops, you got Stegosaurs, you got Ankylosaurs, you got Hadrosaurs, in addition to the Apatosaurs that this film is largely built around. And all of these creatures used to be Arlo's neighbors and friends. And again, as we mentioned, you know, Pete brought the thing down to a manageable, cleaner style and opted to focus in on Arlo, the young Apatosaur's relationship with Spot, his human caveman friend. And movie arrives in theaters November 2015, again, 2 full years behind its original announced release date of November 2013. I'm not going to lie, it's not the perfect Pixar movie, but it has 2 scenes that to this day I genuinely love. That there's that scene down by the river that's wordless, Drew. Do you remember when Arlo and Spot sort of reveal to one another that they've lost their, you know, lost parents? And then...
Yeah, that scene was from the Bob Peterson version, by the way.
Was it really? Okay, good, good. Yeah. Okay. And then there is the scene just before the end. Spoiler alert, folks. The end of the movie where we've seen this caveman family that's been following Arlo and Spot for a time in like the second or third act of the movie. And Arlo makes the really hard decision because he's, at this point, he's come to love Spot, but it's like he, you know, he wants to do right by his human friend. And what's right is to let him go so he can be part of this caveman family that's willing to take him on. And it's, again, it's a beautifully done scene. Do we know if that, which version of the...
I do not know if that was part of Bob's, but I can tell you some stuff off air that I've found out recently about it.
Cool.
I will say that I was at Disney when the movie came out, and I had heard a story from some folks at Consumer Products that they actually went to Pixar and said, listen, you cut out all these dinosaurs, but we really want them for the toys. And they sort of allowed Consumer Products to have the characters as kind of a mea culpa or apology that those characters had been gone. So, yeah, it was a very interesting process to get all that stuff cleared and available as merchandise, as you said, that you could buy. I don't know if anyone had any idea what the hell they were buying, but I know that someone on this call has been collecting them.
Well, I just recently, all right, in fact, I we have Jose to thank for this, because remember, early on in today's show, read Jose's email, and he mentioned how he was going to try to collect all of those Elio, Happy Meal toys. And I have to admit, Drew, there's a part of me that really wants to do the same thing, because I want in, 15 months from now, when I go to see Elio, I'm going to be fascinated to see how many of these Happy Meal toy the characters and the Happy Meal toys actually show up in the finished film. On the other hand, when it came to The Good Dinosaur, I remember standing in the aisle of like Walmart in their toy aisle and looking at these sets that Tomy had put together, where, you know, you had, for example, the T-Rex Ranchers. The delightful characters like two-thirds of the way through, the ones that were herding giant bison, Butch, Nash, and Ramsay. But what was interesting is you'd look into, you know, these toy containers that held Butch, Nash, and Ramsay, and there'd be these other characters you'd never seen before in there. There was like Mary Alice and Sam the Triceratops, or Jack and Vivian the Ankylosaur, or Will the Stegosaurus. And I at that time I stood there and was like, ooh, these, I should get these. But at the same time, it's like, I'm a 56-year-old man. Get it together. You don't need toys. But now, again, 9 years later, 65-year-old, I figured, to hell with it. And so, I initially went on eBay to try to chase down the Elio stuff. Nowhere to be seen, Drew. I don't know if the folks in Mexico realize what they have and they're not putting it up for sale, but I pivoted to The Good Dinosaur. And now, for your amusement, Drew, I hold out. Ooh, look at that camera we got. What is
Who
it?
Is that?
Hang on. I got to get my reference back here. Bah, 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 bah.
That's Mary Alice, I think.
Well, right? No. This is Will the Stegosaur. And again, really appealing design. And then we have Mary Alice, the blue Triceratops. Isn't that a cool design? I mean, it's very, very appealing. And then we have, you know, Jack the Ankylosaur. And Pixar always designs such wonderful looking characters that have immediate street appeal and you can emotionally bond with. And the interesting thing is that we didn't just get the adult dinosaurs. We got the kids. So this is Sam the Triceratops, and this is Vivian the Ankylosaur. For me, the combination of that art in the front of the Art of Good Dinosaur book and these toys, I want somebody, and they can do it discreetly, we won't share it on air, but I want to know how these characters fit into the early, early Bob Peterson take on the good dinosaur. Well, anyway, okay, so that's it, folks. But by the way, if there's somebody down in Mexico who happened to collect an additional set of the Ilia toys who wants to give them to a good home, we could have a conversation. But anyway, thanks again to writer-journalist Jose Mercader for giving us the heads up about what was going on with Ilia down in Mexico, which is what keyed off today's story. And okay, so pivoting now to that wonderful podcast that you do with Charles Hood, what's going on with Light Diffuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast this week?
Oh God, I'm trying to think of where we are in the spectrum, but we're continuing our director series.
Okay.
So we've got Jonathan Lynn, who, if you have ever seen Clue, you know his work. So we talk all about Clue and how that came about. Mm-hmm. We've got Alexander Payne coming up. It's just been a really fun series, so please hang in there, and then of course we'll be back to more Mission Impossible stuff. Mm-hmm. Hopefully sooner rather than later.
Okay, cool, cool, cool. And speaking of podcasts, we do have a few others here at Jim Hill Media, the podcast network we'd like you to check out. These include, of course, Disney Dish, which I do with Len Testa, Brian Gaughan, and I do the Looking at Lucasfilm. In fact, I'm trying to persuade Brian to go down to Disneyland. Season of the Force just started there this week, and they started with a brand new ride film for Star Tours that I'm really interested in. We, of course, have the Epic Universal podcast, which I do with Eric Hersey, the talented gentleman who also produces the podcast here. Also have I Want That Too, which I do with Lauren Hersey, Eric's bride, and that's all about Disney merch. And then, there is, of course, Disney Unpacked, our new video series that Len and I are doing with Imagineer Jim Shull, and this month's show, which debuted, in fact, on the day we're recording this, April 7th, is all about the various Buzz Lightyear-themed shooters that are in Disney parks around the globe. And we're now here at our social media stuff, Drew, where we're still Xing, right? We're still Twittering?
We're still Xing. We're in that X space. Mm-hmm. And everywhere else, just Drew Taylor, like a tailored shirt.
Okay. Cool,
and now, cool, Jim, cool. You have me already looking to see if there's any of this new Star Tours merchandise on eBay yet. And it's not there yet. But I like the hats.
But at the same time, I'm spending too much time on eBay. All right. On the other hand, social media, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram as Jim Hill Media, and over on Facebook as Jim Hill Media News. All right. Final favor before we go here, folks, if you can head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review. Well, again, not just the show you're listening to right now, fine tuning, but if you could also put in a good word for Light Diffuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. I know that Drew and Charles would appreciate that as well. And I think that's going to do it for this week. So on behalf of Mr. Taylor, thank you for listening, and we will be back soon.